It's time once again for Dialogue Conspiracy with May Brussel. For the past 14 years, May has been researching and uncovering facts and evidence from between the lines of the news and placing them in a more thorough perspective of how conspiracy, political assassination, and abuses of power affect us all. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KLRB-FM in Carmel, California. And now, May Brussel.
Good evening. This is May Brussel. It's Dialogue Conspiracy number 314, and it's March the 26th, 1978. At first, in celebration of Easter, I was going to read certain sections of Wilhelm Reich's book, The Murder of Christ, which is one of my favorite books. Wilhelm Reich was violently anti-Nazi. He was also anti-communist and a great philosopher, and has written books on the origins of fascism. And also, The Murder of Christ is an important book because he tells how we continuously are in a trap and we don't get out of this trap because we don't ask the right questions, and therefore we're not getting the right answers. And that man has literally slaved himself, that he's born free and he ends up a slave. I wonder if he really is born free, but Wilhelm Reich believes that, or has the potential to be free. And in this book, he talks about the crucifixion of Jesus as a conspiracy and plot, and that these same kinds of murders and assassinations that are going on now of the individuals or large masses of people is a continuation of the same mentality. The same kind of people that were killing Jesus are killing today for the same reasons, and that the unsolved reason of why Jesus was killed is the reason that these murders and assassinations go on now, that we have all the religions we need and all the philosophers we need, and yet the world doesn't get better. It just gets worse. I like the book, and maybe on another program I will go into it. In case you don't know the book, it's called The Murder of Christ by Wilhelm Reich. It came out in 1953. As I say, he died in American prison under mysterious circumstances. He was brought in on some charges that were laid upon him. We can go into details on that, that had nothing to do with his philosophy, and people were misusing his principles on cancer research and his particular suggestions for cure for cancer. And because people were using his suggestions and misusing his information, he was arrested and put in prison, and then he died in prison. But I thought I would continue where I left off last week, and just caught up on some of the articles I have on my desk that I do want to go into, that I don't have time to speak about at depth, but I want to keep you on top of some of the news. I also wanted to do a resume of the shows that I've done since last year. It was just March 28th last year, Sunday, that I started taping the shows, not only for my own personal use. I have all the shows from the past 6 years, or almost all of them, but to get them out to people at cost, the tape cassettes of Dialogue Conspiracy. And if any of you want the subject titles of the shows for the past year, the dates and the cost and the names of the subjects, you can send me a self-addressed stamped envelope. Be sure to stamp it and put your name inside. And I'll send you a list of these shows, and you can go through these. And I'd like to probably next week take some of these shows and give an update account of what happened in this last year since we did these programs on Dialogue Conspiracy. An example is program number 284. That was in August 1977, August 29th. And I did a program on the murder of Elvis Presley and how he was drugged. And then in November of 1977, a few months later, the medical doctors in Memphis, Tennessee began to reopen the inquiry of how Elvis Presley was dead, and they said the subject should be investigated by the president of Memphis and Shelby County Medical Society, that there were conflicts in the official reports, and they questioned that his death was drug-related, and they felt that there was some collusion of persons misrepresenting both the autopsy report and the circumstances on the death of Elvis Presley that I called murder. I believe that he was murdered. The King of Rock was murdered. I also talked several times about the Gemstone File. I did several broadcasts on the Gemstone File and various persons that were named in this controversial document, and many people have ordered it from me. If you don't have that, I've reproduced those. They're $2 a copy for 30 pages put out by Bruce Roberts. a summary of the way the various conspiracies and intrigues have been going on since 1932, beginning with Aristotle, the role of Aristotle Onassis, and then up through 1972. Bruce Roberts, who wrote the Gemstone Files, died a few years, about a year ago, of brain tumor. Programs January 1st and January 8th this year were of the Gemstone File. Now, it's interesting, December the 25th, that I did a program on a part of the Gemstone File and Bruce Roberts and the fact that Paul Krasner became the publisher of Hustler magazine. And then just before Larry Flynt was shot and almost fatally killed, he was in Cincinnati, Ohio, speaking about the Gemstone File and referring to this as a possible reason for people to be killed. He said, whoever has the Gemstone File is killed, whoever has his outline of how the conspiracies take place. And about 3 weeks later, Larry Flynt was shot. But all that he had was the Gemstone key, that resume that I will mail to you at cost if you want it. He didn't have the 300 or 400 pages of the whole file, because running through that file are names of various people, such as Mayor Joe Alioto in San Francisco, with his links to organized crime, and also John Tunney, and former Senator John Tunney. And here was Larry Flynt talking about the Gemstone File in Cincinnati, and he doesn't know what's in it. And I heard from three different sources that John Tunney became the attorney for Larry Flynt when he took over the L.A. Free Press and went into the assassination business in Los Angeles, California. The offices where he located Mark Lane and Dick Gregory and the Realist offices with Art Kunkin, to get out the Realist again, are the floor above John Tunney's offices in Century City. And yet, I have an article here dated December the 30th, 1976, from the Los Angeles Times about the notorious Flying Tigers and the Flying Tiger line and how it was used and funded and gave airplanes to John Tunney, and it gives the amount of money, and supplied him with election money in 1970. And also John Tunney's name comes out in reference to possible Howard Hughes money that was given for his campaigns. So if the group in Los Angeles were to investigate these assassinations and they were to do any research, they would go a little further, I would believe, into the entire Gemstone File and look up the evidence or the information about John Tunney, and if he is their attorney and has the offices above, I think it's a thing to look into, because I believe that the people that are mentioned in the Gemstone File, several members of organized crime, probably were the ones who shot Larry Flynt, but he was working with out of his element with a whole ball game that he didn't know, and he got done in because he was going a little too far, and yet was encircled with these people who have worked with these CIA counterintelligence gangs. Also, during the year, I've talked about Howard Hughes on various programs on Dialogue Conspiracy, on the kidnapping of Howard Hughes. I talked about that last October 1977 and in June of 77. I've done many references to Howard Hughes, and just this last week, a doctor and an aide who took care of Howard Hughes have been indicted for giving him drugs. Now, it's interesting, this story comes only to the Las Vegas Sun. So it didn't come over the Associated Press or the United Press. And I'll share it with you now. The headline this week, Friday, March 17th, says, "Doctor indicted federal Hughes habit. A longtime aide and personal physician of the late Howard Hughes conspired to feed the industrialist narcotics from 1955 to 1974. Dr. Norman F. Crane, 72, and John Morrison Holmes, 62, were indicted on conspiring to furnish codeine phosphate and emperor codeine to Howard Hughes. The two men supplied Hughes with these drugs at his residences in California, England, Canada, and the Bahamas, the indictment charges. Dr. Crane and Mr. Holmes are ordered to appear in the U.S. District Court on March 24, 1978. Hughes took drugs orally and by injections. In 1957, this indictment goes on, and this is important because that's the year that I've said on Dialogue Conspiracy through the years that Howard Hughes began to be drugged out of his mind, and then his empire was taken over. The indictment says in 1957, Holmes told the Hughes aide, Roy Crawford, that he'd like to fill prescriptions at the Roxbury Pharmacy on Olympic Boulevard in Los Angeles because he knew the pharmacist. This is in the indictment. They got these prescriptions, and prescriptions were also written in the names of George Frankham, LeVar Marlar, and Clarence Waldron. Now, those men haven't been indicted, and I'm wondering why. Both Dr. Norman Crane and John Holmes in 1974 said that they wanted to get out of the drug supply scheme, but they were in it at least up to then and even longer. The indictment says that 480 prescriptions allegedly written for use by Dr. Crane, 180 were in Mr. Holmes' name, 168 were in Crawford's name, 73 in Frankham's, and 59 in Mylar's. Mr. Crawford transported 36 of the prescriptions to use. Mr. Holmes took 387 of the prescriptions to use. And how the 57 other prescriptions were taken, they do not know. In 1971, the indictment claims Mr. Holmes told Clarence Waldron that he should be able to use each aide's name for the prescriptions for the morphine derivatives to conceal that they were really for Howard Hughes. Mr. Holmes was hired by Howard Hughes in 1949 to escort his starlets to their dancing lessons and music lessons, became an aide in 1957, the year that Howard Hughes was then zonked out of his head, which, as I say, is the exact date I pinpointed, and now and still does draws a salary of $92,500 a year, with no training as a secretary, a medical aide of any kind. He's drawing this salary. Now, this is important because the memos that we talked about on Dialogue Conspiracy just March the 5th of this year with Douglas Wallace and Preston Truman went into the memos that were in the hotel room and when Howard Hughes, or that person allegedly Hughes, was in Mexico. And in these memos, the subject of the will came out. And at that time, in 74, there was a will of Howard Hughes, and in 76, there was an existing will, a handwritten will that Nadine Henley, the top aide of Summa Corporation, one of the top aides, had. This will existed. And then Johnny Holmes, the same man that's indicted now, admitted in the court hearings regarding the Mormon will that he himself in Las Vegas destroyed all personal papers belonging to Howard Hughes. So up until 1970, personal papers belonging to Howard Hughes were destroyed by Johnny Holmes. Johnny Holmes was supplying literally hundreds of injections and pills, up to the tune of many, many hundreds, at least what they admit, enough to keep a man zonked out of his head, gone completely since 57. The empire was taken over. Two men have been indicted. The others aren't yet. But nobody yet has been charged with murder or conspiracy to murder or kidnapping. And to drug a man like that since 1957, to do away with a will which did exist, and everyone who's close to the association knew it existed, to destroy his personal papers and still draw a salary of $92,500 plus all the French benefits is really outrageous. And so if you keep up with Dialogue Conspiracy and order the back shows and keep up with the current, you'll get information such as that that does not go over the Associated Press and United Press wire services. You see, the big problem with these news services is who is controlling it today. I just did a four-hour show with Ray Bream in Los Angeles, a radio show Friday night, Saturday morning, from 12 at night till 4 in the morning. And the whole Southwest area was very much interested. It was a different ballgame than when I did shows with Ray 2 or 3 years ago. And the people, everyone who called in for 4 hours, completely understood the problems. But we can't come up with the solution, because to admit conspiracies exist in the Los Angeles Police Department, with the killing of Sirhan Sirhan, and the John Kennedy assassination, in the Howard Hughes case, the evidence is all there, the payoffs are all there. But who keeps covering it up now? A man named Gerald Ford was at the Warren Commission and said, "I can handle the Associated Press and United Press." That was at one of their very first meetings, and that was in the minutes of the meetings. But does he still control it? Who controlled Gerald Ford? Gerald Ford was a selected agent for Congress in 1946, like Richard Nixon, when members of the Hughes organization came up to him in Michigan and ran him for Congress, the House of Representatives. And in California that year, Richard Nixon was put up against Jerry Voorhees, and Claude Pepper was put up in Florida, all by the same teams. But that was 1946. Who is controlling the news now? There's another example of news control. As I say, on Dialogue Conspiracy, March the 5th of this year, just two, 3 weeks ago, Douglas Wallace was with me and brought those papers, and you can get the tape recording of that show if you missed it or if you want to have it as a collector's item. I think they're important to save. Douglas Wallace talked about the fact that a federal judge in Utah hears all cases pertaining to Howard Hughes and Summa Corporation, and yet, even with the memos taken from the Hughes people, Judge Anderson has been in their pocket. Well, after he left here, we did the program here March the 5th. He went back to Portland, Oregon, and March the 11th, there was a headline story in the Las Vegas Sun. It was a UPI story. That means the United Press International covered a press conference that Doug Wallace had. The Associated Press didn't have a story. Reuters didn't have it. The Los Angeles Times didn't pick it up. The New York Times, the Washington Post, none of the papers that I take, the 10 a day, nor anybody I know, has seen this story except one article, a headline across two columns of the Las Vegas Sun, March the 11th. It said, Mormon renegade Douglas Wallace, they call him a renegade because he is a high priest in the Mormon Church who has differed from the church because of their fascist leanings and their genocidal policies. It says, Mormon renegade Douglas Wallace cited a secret in-house memo from Howard Hughes, it was in the files in Mexico, and asked for the impeachment of federal Judge Anderson, who's handling Hughes cases in Utah. Wallace had a security guard on hand to guard against the theft of what were 4,000 pages of first-generation mimeographed copies from the Hughes files. He asked that Judge Alden J. Anderson be removed from the federal court as a federal judge in Utah. He cited communication of Chester Davis in August of 1975 with memos that asserted, in quotes, communication from Chester Davis, the Summa attorney, and one of the triumvirate running the Hughes empire at the time, have said that Chester says Johnny Meyer, this is a man who used to work for Howard Hughes and then was sued by the Hughes people, Johnny Meyer will have to be destroyed. Now that we have Judge Anderson in our pocket in Utah, we should not let him get away. This was a memo found among the Howard Hughes possessions. Judge Anderson was hearing the case where the Summa Corporation had a lawsuit against Johnny Meyer for taking money from them in a swindling, land swindling charge. And there were also memos that Howard Hughes said, Meyer didn't steal money from me. I trust Johnny Meyer. He didn't do anything wrong. And yet Judge Anderson wouldn't allow this to be entered into the court, that even the Hughes papers themselves from Mexico said that he trusted Meyer and that Meyer had not hurt the Hughes Corporation. So the memo says we must continue to say that you do not know Meyer, did not know Meyer was getting any money on the mining deals. If Meyer has any memo from you available on the subject, we will go in and deny it. This was a communication of the attorneys in the Howard Hughes organization. They went on to say, we can destroy Meyer's credibility. He cannot financially hold out against us forever. It will be a warning to Robert Mayhew and Hank Greenspun, that's the publisher of the Las Vegas Sun. We intend business all around. Now, that memo came out and was exposed. Judge Anderson wouldn't allow any of this in his court, and Judge Anderson has been named as being in the control. Now Johnny Meyer is trying to open banks in the South Pacific, and the Hughes people have gone in there and tried to break him and break him financially. And the judge suddenly, on this case, gave a reversal to Meyer's favorite position and found him guilty, and the Summa people could collect $5 million for a decision against Johnny Meyer. This case and the press conference that Doug Wallace had after he left my home, where I told you he had these 4,000 pages that we went through, it was held but not covered anywhere in the world. You can carry documents and memos and get them directly from the police in Mexico City. Only three copies are available in the world, and yet this doesn't make the news or the wire service, and therefore you have to hear it on KLRB. I've talked a lot during the year on the various programs, looking over the list on mind control and the use of the intelligence community for programming people for these mass murders, an excuse for terror on the streets. I gave specific examples of Son of Sam David Berkowitz in New York, and the various people coming out of veterans hospitals, mental hospitals, and prisons, or people at large, engineers and prominent people in the community, who all of a sudden are hearing messages and going berserk, who've been in the hands of physicians and who I believe are being trained to kill for just senseless terrorism. There was a chance for one of these senseless terrorists to come to trial this week in San Francisco, and just when he was ready to come to trial, he was found dead in his cell. There's no way to get to their heads to see if there's electrode implants. There's no way to get autopsies on these cases. And I follow these various random murders, and those of you that listen to Dialogue Conspiracy can cut out for me and mail to me like many people do. Every time you see a murder of one person or three or four or these massacres, save the articles and mail them to me and see what the suspect says, such as Gary Gilmore saying, "There was a veil over my eyes. I had to kill. I couldn't stop myself." And then we traced him to this hospital in Boston where he had multiple electroshock. The article in the San Francisco Chronicle this week says, in quotes, "Demon killer dies waiting sanity hearing." It involves an 87-year-old woman who was killed in San Francisco, Laura B. Dunnigan. And she very innocently, she wasn't doing anything in particular, but a 30-year-old man, Carl Kasperson, a civil engineer, killed her. He knew her, and he said, "The demons made me do it." So instead of being charged with a murder trial, they temporarily judged him insane for 2 years and waited to have another sanity hearing. And he was supposed to go before the courts in Redwood City. He was brought to San Mateo County Jail in Redwood City, waiting for the hearings where he would be taken to see about his mental condition. But all of a sudden, he was taken to Chope Hospital, C-H-O-P-E, in San Mateo, where he very quickly died. The coroner, Paul Jensen, said yesterday, that's this week, that a preliminary autopsy showed that he apparently, not for sure, but apparently, died from a hemorrhaging pancreas. Just at the time where he may have had 2 years to think about the circumstances that the civil engineer heard demons telling him to kill this woman, he couldn't go into the trial or go into a psychiatric record or anything like that. When he was ready to go to trial, they took him to a hospital, and the pancreas hemorrhaged, and there is one more unknown berserk killer going. There's another problem on mind control. Last week I was talking about mind control and germ and swine flu, and this subject is very much on my mind, and it concerns me. A very fine researcher who supplies me with information and takes my tapes every week and duplicates them has a member of her family who's about ready to go from high school and graduate and go to college, and all of a sudden he became like paranoid schizophrenic. People were following him. He was hearing things. He was hearing conversations, and every time he'd look in the mirror, he's saying, "I'm ugly, I'm ugly," and he is in a state of confusion, which I'm getting from other people all around me. A well-known radio person in California, I can't mention the name, is having deep problems with his family, and a particular child who's the same age, in the same period in school, and adolescence, and ready almost to go to college, and all of a sudden he's going bananas, and the diagnosis of the one son was identical back east to the diagnosis of this person out in California, that part of their motor of their brain skips, and there's electric timing that the brain isn't synchronized, and this person is looking in the mirror and saying, "I'm ugly, I'm ugly." Now, I don't want to embarrass people or even suggest or hint who's suffering from this, but if any of you listen to the shows or get these tapes, know of any other circumstances where you have children who, say, have taken marijuana or grass, but no other drug that you know of or chemical, who believe that they're being followed, if you're political and write letters to your congressman or get the tapes to Dialogue Conspiracy, or just know if you've taken political stances of a kind or your children are aware of politics in the family, please supply me with any information you have. If any symptoms overlap, these may be the biggest coincidences that just happen to come in my mailbox within 2 weeks' time. But I certainly believe that there are coincidences in Nazi Germany that weren't investigated that should have been, and people could have put things together quicker had they the tape cassette and the radio and the means by which to communicate, which still isn't cut off completely. Another story that the United Press International, Associated Press, didn't carry, that you have to learn from Dialogue Conspiracy, or else if you take the New York Post, it was there. The real son of Sam killed himself. Now, this is an interesting story, and I want to read it to you. And then if you want to get the tapes on my show on Dialogue Conspiracy, Dialogue Conspiracy number 282 and 283, I talk about David Berkowitz, the son of Sam, and the CIA profile they had on him, and that he was a victim of the LSD and testing of the Army program because he was against war and for peace, and he was in South Korea, that the police department and the CIA terrorist groups turned David Berkowitz into this killer who literally had to stalk New York City for a year. And then when the message was done and the mayor races were over and the police law enforcement squad teams were all set up, David Berkowitz was quietly put into a cell, and you never hear any more about him. Now, he kept saying that a man, Sam Carr, who lived right below him, had a dog, and that Sam was influencing him electronically in some way, that he was getting messages to kill from Sam. And Sam's daughter, as I said on other shows, was a woman who worked for the sheriff's department in the area. Her name was Wheat. She's 26 years old, and she was a dispatcher for the Yonkers Police Department and played a role in when they eventually led to David Berkowitz. It was Sam's daughter, the daughter of the man that he said was making him do the murders, who played a role in taking the police to David Berkowitz's apartment. Now, the son of Sam, the real son of Sam, died mysteriously just in February last month. And I want to read you this before I go off the air. This is New York Post, Wednesday, February 22nd, 1978. The son of the real Sam kills himself. The son of the real Sam in the David Berkowitz case committed suicide under mysterious circumstances in North Dakota. In the latest bizarre twist surrounding the son of Sam suspect, David Berkowitz, the so-called .44 caliber killings, John Carr, 31, was found dead, apparently, like the man that died of the ruptured pancreas, apparently self-inflicted gunshot last Thursday. Carr is the son of Sam Carr, 64 years old, of Yonkers, New York, whose dog and whose person, David Berkowitz maintained, gave him the orders to do these murderous rampages. Young Carr's body was found with his skull demolished, a bullet fired into his mouth by a .30-30 rifle, identical to Carlos Prius Siqueiros and the George de Morenchild deaths and a lot of others. He was discovered late Friday night in a civilian apartment where he stayed on the U.S. Air Force Base at Minot in North Dakota, 50 miles south of the Canadian border in North Dakota. The rifle was next to his body. No note was found. And, of course, a rifle in the mouth means don't talk about your daddy or sister, I guess. It says, we don't know whether his death has anything to do with the Son of Sam case, the county sheriff said, Terrence Gardner. As far as we're concerned, the motive is unknown, but it's really very strange. The younger Carr was never linked publicly with his father like his sister was, but there was speculation that he may have been referred to once in writing by David Berkowitz, who mentioned John Wheaties, a rapist and a suffocator of young girls. It seems that David Berkowitz named this person. Now, Wheat was the name of the Sam Carr's children. One of them, as I say, his daughter, Wheat, worked for the sheriff's office, and David Berkowitz had mentioned something about John Wheaties, a rapist and a killer. And John Carr, 31, was found dead just in February. Sam Carr has a daughter named Wheat, and it was not known if the dead son may also use Wheat at times as a middle name or a nickname, because Sam talked about John Wheat as being the rapist and the murderer, and saying that his father was the one who told David Berkowitz to go out on these rampages. Sam Carr's address in Westchester County, there is a listing there also for John Wheat Carr. John Wheaties was referred to in the messages and letters that David Berkowitz wrote last June to columnist Jimmy Breslin, and the significance yet has not been put together. Well, I see I only have one more minute now, and I may go a little more back on to Sam and go over some of the shows of last year to show you how important they are and how these leads that I'm giving you, if you follow them months and years later, you will see the pieces come together. I think this case of John Wheaties being killed, shot in the mouth at this time, and being named in these memos is terribly important, and maybe we'll start that off next week. Meanwhile, those of you who are celebrating Easter still this evening, and this will come late back east for those of you who already had the holidays pass, read Murder of Christ by Wilhelm Reich. Have a good year, and I'll see you next week, or I'll be speaking with you on Dialogue Conspiracy.
You've been listening to Dialogue Conspiracy with Mae Brussels.